And after on page 150, we're going to talk about Haggai and Zechariah. We're going to get to what the conditions were like after the exile. But let's do a little of a review and preview, first of all, okay? We said we were going to talk about how Daniel predicted Palm Sunday, and he did predict it down to the very day, and that's why Jesus said in Luke 19, if you'd only known on this day what would bring you peace. And even the cartoons confirmed the truth of that. How we know that Daniel loved Deuteronomy was simply because of the word so. After he learns from Jeremiah that there are 70 years are almost up, it says he confessed his sin. That's in Daniel chapter 9, verse 3. And he is doing that because Deuteronomy 30 says you must repent in order to get back. We saw the road that Jerusalem that God always takes. Now, I'm not trying to be flippant about this. I hope I don't offend anybody. But the beam me up part, you know, where God goes back to heaven, the Holy Spirit goes to heaven, or where Jesus goes back up to heaven, always comes from the Mount of Olives. And why the folks at Pentecost had flames in their head? Because they were little temples with the glory of God hovering over. So that's where we were. Here's what we're going to take a look at today with Haggai and Zechariah. Why all the returnees found it hard to worship with all their hearts. Those people who did come back found themselves in a very discouraging situation for a number of reasons. And we'll talk about that. Number two, where Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah fit in relation to the exile. That's pretty important to get that chronology into your head. Number three, why Haggai said, if you build it, he will come. You guys watch Field of Dreams and your kids? Okay, well, Haggai said it before, whatever his name was, said it. And then why the branch is a good metaphor for Messiah. It's used all over the Old Testament. You may not have mentioned it or noticed it before, but it is. And Zechariah mentions it. So here we go. On page 150, we're going to talk about the kingdom before and after the exile. And as I've subtitled it here, Israel is just a pale shadow of her former self after she returns to the land. And if you evaluate it in terms of these four categories, you see why. Because in terms of a king, what did we have before the exile? Well, at least we had a king. Afterwards, what do we have? We have a person with royal blood, but eventually we go from king to carpenter, right? Because we're talking about Joseph here, because the people with royal blood from Zerubbabel on down do not, in fact, reign on the throne. They don't have political independence, and so we don't have a king. We have a guy who we want to be king, but we can't do it because the other kingdoms are in charge. The temple. We go from a Porsche to a Geo Metro, if you know what I mean. We used to have this little game called on the computer called Midtown Madness. You guys ever see this game? And you'd race around Chicago, and you could have various kinds of cars. And Geo Metro was the cheap economy car, and we'd play it, and you'd bump each other off. And my youngest daughter, who was about 10 or 12 at the time, she was pretty good at this game. And we were driving in Xenia one day, and up in front of us, she said, "Look, Dad, Geo Metro, hit it!" And I thought, "Oh gosh." Maybe you shouldn't let her watch this. But the point is that what Solomon made, this Porsche, this beautiful, elaborate wonder of the ancient world, after it's destroyed, Zerubbabel comes back and rebuilds this squatty little temple that's so small that the people who were children when they saw Solomon's temple destroyed survive the exile and return, and they see the new one built, they see the foundation new one built, they cry, not for joy, but because they say, oh, it's so sad, it's so little, so squatty, if you only could have seen what was here before. Right? We go from the Urim and Thummim to clueless. Now, Urim and Thummim are Hebrew words, of course, and they are never translated because no one exactly knows how to translate them. So the translators don't. They just give you the Hebrew words. And we think what it referred to was this little breastplate on the high priest. You know this guy's the high priest because he's got the blue, okay? All the other priests had white. But the high priest has this little breastplate of the stones that would somehow give you direct communication with God. We don't know exactly how. Some people think the Urim and Thummim are like lots or like dice that you would roll. role, but I don't think that's true because they would give you more than just yes or no answers. It was more than like on or off. We don't know if the lights would flash, you know, or what would happen. But there are times in the Old Testament where people really want to get a direct word from God. David does this several times. One time David says, we've got to go fight the Philistines, so how should we do it? God, we want to know. And so he goes and he asks the priest, the high priest, who has the Urim and Thummim, and the answer comes back, and the answer is, set an ambush around this spot, and then attack from this side and do this. It's a fairly complex thing. It's not just a yes, you should, or no, you shouldn't. It's not like an eight ball, you know, where you'd see the answer yes or no. But it's kind of like a direct line to heaven. Okay, all that to say this. When we come back from the exile, and we get back over here to Jerusalem, they're not really quite sure which people can be priests because they have lost their genealogical records. So they go to the high priest and they say, could you give us direct word from God on the answer to this question? And it's a very sad situation because the high priest says, you know what? We don't have the Urim and Thummim anymore. We lost it. We don't know where it is. It's like, you don't. It's like, man, what happened to it? And here's just another one of those advantages that we used to have before that we don't have now. We used to be able to communicate with God and get a direct answer, but we don't. Wouldn't you like to have that? Wouldn't that be nice? A direct line to heaven? Should I ask her out this Friday night or should I not? God, what's the answer? And then the Holy of Holies, which is probably the worst one, because we go from glory to empty. And the reason for that is what you saw Wednesday, because the Spirit of God leaves and does not come back. So this is why Ezra and Nehemiah and Malachi have a really difficult time getting people to get excited about worship this temple. They say, why should we even come? We don't have a king. We have a squatty little temple. The high priest is walking around, you know, going blah, 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 blah. He doesn't have the agreement to me. And God isn't even home. You see, but it's functioning. The temple is functioning, you know. We've got the bread there. We've got the incense there. We've got the lights there. This is where the original phrase comes from, folks. The lights are on, but nobody's home, right? So why should we come worship, right? So here's the situation between before and after. It's pretty difficult. 2a, the purpose and nature of the exile. Why is there an exile? And that's an easy one to answer for us. We know there's an exile because Deuteronomy 28 says there has to be if there is continual corporate disobedience. 2b, life during the exile, unfortunately, was pretty good. And I say unfortunately because life was often so good in Babylon, people didn't want to come back. So there weren't nearly as many people returned as left. And finally, 3b, the length of the exile. Now we talk about this Jerusalem being destroyed in 586, people returning in 536, and didn't take a barrel of mathematical brains to realize that totals up to what number? It's only 50, right? Not 70. But the way we get 70 is this. When the people were first taken away, like when Daniel was first taken away in the first deportation, it was 605. So if you count from 605 to 536, you get about 70 years. Right? And the temple is destroyed in 586, but it's not finished in its reconstruction until 516. So the people are gone 70 years. The temple is down 70 years. So they're overlapping. They're not exactly the same, but that's why we talk about the 70-year exile. Right? Now, take a look at this little chart. There are three things I want you to notice from this chart. Probably going to need to study it a little bit for the celebration. Right? And pay attention to these things. Number one, 536 is the date of the return. That means that everything to the left is where the exile is, okay? The exile is previous to this, if this is a chronological timeline. The exile is to the left, and that means that everything in here is post-exile. So that everything which happens after 536 is after the exile is over, the people have returned to the land, or at least they're able to return to the land. And so Zechariah and Haggai and Esther and Chronicles and Malachi, all this stuff happens after the exile. Right? That's the first big idea. The second thing I want you to know is this. Zechariah and Haggai come and they preach around 520 to 516. Now, if you just flip over your notes real quickly to page 151, you'll notice under the introduction, under the author, you'll see the dates. And Haggai has four dates in it, August 29, September 21, October 17, December 18. You see those four dates? Haggai has very, very specific dates that are given to it because we can date his prophecy very specifically. Now, that's important, and here's why it's important. All right? Eyes back up here. When we first come back, right here, when Zerubbabel comes back, he starts to rebuild the temple, indicated by the short little green square. Okay? It's going. It's green. That's why it's going. Okay. But very soon after, there's opposition, and it is stopped for 16 years. And then what happens is that Haggai and Zechariah come along, and their singular purpose is to get this temple rebuilt again. And so they start right there in 520, in the fall of 520 BC. And over the next 4 years, they get it going again, and sure enough, by 516, it is finished. All right? So I want you to kind of connect the dates there with Haggai and Zechariah and their purpose. The reason why they come is to get that thing going again. And that's what they do. And they are very successful in it. That's the second thing. The third thing I want you to know is why we have the book spelled Ezra-ah. Does that make any sense to you at all? Anybody figure out why we do it like that? Okay, maybe it's a good thing to explain it. Yeah, the last few chapters are quite a bit later on. Let me explain it to you exactly. This part right here, 7 to 10, is Ezra's lifetime. What's going on in Ezra chapter 7 to 10 is what he knows about and what he lives and what he writes about. As he introduces his book, however, the first six chapters, this part is ancient history. This happens 80 years before the guy, not 80 years before he's born, but 80 years before his adult life. Okay, so he's looking back and he tells this ancient story, which makes a really good introduction to what he wants to talk about. But he didn't live it. It's simply a recap of what happened 80 years before in order to get to his big idea that he wants to talk about in 7 to 10. So that's why we put Ezra like that. Okay? All right, you happy with this? All right, let's go on then, and let's talk about Haggai and Zechariah a little bit. On page 151, you will notice the line at the top says introduction to both Haggai and Zechariah. I want to talk about the two of them together here for a second, because in some ways they represent good cop, bad cop. They minister together in community as a team. And if you're familiar with the good cop, bad cop scenario, maybe your parents played this from time to time. You know, good parent, bad parent, heavy parent, a nice parent. I don't know what to relate to you, just to work both angles, to have different styles. That's kind of what they are. They have very different styles. Very different styles, but very singular in purpose. See the temple reconstruction completed. So if you were to meet these two guys, you'd think, man, those guys are very different personalities. But God uses both of them in their own ways to accomplish something. And there's probably a little bit of a pattern there for team ministry or for, you know, different gifts in the body that are very different personalities, but work together in an effective way. You see this in your notes as well. One of them is direct, one of them is very indirect. One is practical, one is visionary. One is immediate, the other thinks about the ultimate, what's going to happen in the ultimate future. One is very specific, one is fairly general. One's detailed and deals with nuts and bolts, the other is more abstract and conceptual. So can you guess which prophet belongs in which column? Who is the more direct, practical, immediate, specific, and detailed person? Yeah, that's Haggai, and Zechariah is the guy who's over here, the very visionary sort of person. When we used to have time, I would sometimes actually had a prophet dress up and come into the room and pretend he was a basketball coach at halftime and would give basketball advice. And the first coach, Haggai, would just talk about fundamentals and say you had to block out, you had to control the ball and all that sort of thing, and just do the fundamentals of what you have to do. And the second prophet would come in, he'd be Zechariah, and he would talk about, you know, very visionary, inspiring things and say, I see you as the MVP at the end of this tournament, and I see you getting 20 rebounds bounds and the stuff that would inspire you. Didn't exactly tell you exactly what to do, but just the inspiration, motivational kind of thing. All right. So let's talk about Haggai here for a second. Here is a very typical spot out of Haggai, just one passage, where he says, go up into the mountains, bring down the timber, and build a temple. Right? That's the kind of motivation you get out of him. Not motivation, just direct, immediate, here's what you have to do. What you brought home, I blew away. And he's talking here about their income. People were saying, well, we can't do this because we don't have enough money to give. And he says, well, because what you brought home in your paycheck, I blew away. Why? Well, because of my house, which remains a ruin while each of you is busy with his own house. That is, if you would put your priorities right and give to the temple building, first of all, then I would make sure you had enough money for your own houses. But you have spent it on yourselves first instead of God's work, and that's why priorities are mixed up, and that's why you find yourselves always scratching for dollars. Okay. He also does say, he's the one who says, if you build this temple right here, Messiah himself will come to it. And I don't know about you, but that sounds a little bit more visionary like Zechariah, but that'd be a pretty interesting motivation, don't you think? I mean, if I were there and you said, if you build this building, Messiah's going to come, I'd do it, wouldn't you? And that's all we have time for with Haggai. You'll probably be upset with me. I'll probably have to answer in heaven for it, but that's it. Okay, so here we go to Zechariah. Ooh, I was going to say, I didn't think you spelled Zechariah that way. That's H got left over there. Zechariah is known for his 8 night visions. He has these visions all in one night. And they are again, very visionary, supposed to be very inspiring, often dealing with the ultimate future. But again, the idea is, hey, listen, if in fact we're going to win, if in fact God is on our side, let's get this building built. So I wanted to show you a couple examples of them, all right? His first vision has to do with horses and riders and the ideas that God will avenge. During the night I had a vision, and there before me was a man riding a red horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees in a ravine. Behind him were red, brown, and white horses. These are 4 horses, and they kind of have a reflection in the book of Revelation, the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. And they reported, we've gone throughout the earth and found the whole world at rest and in peace. Now, remember, this is post-exile, okay? And you might think, well, the whole world's at peace, that's a good thing, right? But the truth is, it's not really a good thing. One time when I was about 12 years old, I had a cousin who lived in the house next to us, and he was 16, and his favorite pastime in the summer was beating up his little cousin, namely me, okay? Not out of meanness, but just, I don't know, that's the way 16-year-old kids are to their 12-year-old cousins, I guess. And I remember one time he had me over in the backyard and had me down on my back, and he loved to get me down on my back and put his knees on my hands, you know, so I couldn't fight back, and he would take little pieces of grass and stick them up my nose. I just hated it. And one time he was doing this to me, and my mom, in, you know, through the kitchen, heard some commotion, said, are you boys okay? And I thought, oh, this is my chance, you know. So I started to yell. And as I started to yell, he put his hand over my mouth. So I was going, oh, that's all I can get out. And then he answers back in the meanwhile, are you boys okay? Oh, yeah, everything's fine. And I'm thinking, yeah, fine for you. It's not very fine for me. And that's the kind of situation you got going on here. The whole world's at peace, and Israel's sitting here with their back on the ground thinking, yeah, it's fine for you. It's not for us because we're sitting on the ground overwhelmed by the nations. And so the story goes on like this. I'm very angry with the nations that feel secure. I was only a little angry, but they added to the calamity, talking about the destruction in 586. Therefore, this is what the Lord says. I will return to Jerusalem with mercy, and there my house will be rebuilt, and the measuring line will be stretched out over Jerusalem in order to rebuild it, declares the Lord Almighty. So kind of a promise that God knows the situation. He will come back and he will make sure this place gets rebuilt one way or another at one time or another. The second vision, the 4 horns and craftsmen. This one's kind of funny because the only way you can really illustrate this is with cartoon figures. It's really a very interesting little metaphor. I looked up and there before me were 4 horns. And again, this is probably a reflection of the 4 major kingdoms in Daniel, right? Medo-Persia, Babylon, Greece, and Rome that overwhelm Israel. And the horns, again, are symbolic of governmental power. So I see these 4 horns. And I asked the angel who was speaking to me, what are these? He answered, these are the horns that scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And then the Lord showed me 4 craftsmen. the craftsmen, you know, like ivory carvers, you know, that would come and carve up an elephant tusk or something like that. He answered, "These are the horns that scattered Judah so that no one could raise his head. But the craftsmen have come to terrify them and throw down these horns of the nations who lifted their horns against the land of Judah to scatter his people." So it's like you have these little horns that are personified, you know, and little horns are fooling around together, and then all of a sudden they see these craftsmen on the side with these knives coming to carve them up, and it's kind of a cartoonish sort of a picture, but again, the idea is I'm going to take care of these four nations in time. Now, let me get you to the big one, the one that you probably have heard parts of before and didn't know exactly where it came from. Zechariah chapter 4, the golden lampstand. And here's how it goes. He asked me, "What do you see?" I answered, "I see a solid gold lampstand with a bowl at the top and seven lights on it, with seven channels to the lights. Also, there are two olive trees by it, one on the right of the bowl and one, the other, on its left." So the picture you've got is something like this. You've got two olive trees. Right? I know they look like maple trees, but it's the best we could do with our Western clip art. Okay? You got two olive trees, and then you've got these pipes that come from it, and they go to this menorah. Now, remember that in the ancient world here, especially in Israel, this menorah is not powered by wax. What's it powered by? Well, do you see what's going on here? The pipes come from olive trees to the light. So how long is this light going to burn, theoretically? Yeah, forever, right? The idea is you've got this continual flow of power. And so what it's trying to say is that Joshua, who is the high priest, and Zerubbabel, who is the royal leader, God is going to work through them supernaturally by his spirit to create this power or this energy flow so that he will have a light in the world. And so again, it's a very figurative picture in order to demonstrate the fact that God is not going to leave himself without a witness. There's going to be a temple that will be rebuilt, and the power will flow to it, and the light will go out. And here's the way the text actually states it. This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. "Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit," or the spirit empowering, working through these two guys,